Good afternoon, everyone. We'll call to order the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Public Safety Subcommittee. Today we have the continued OSP hearings regarding House Bill 5045, and I'll open the public hearing. Yesterday we were able to finish up with the Patrol Division. Today I think we're going to try and get through all of these, the Fish and Wildlife, Gaming Division, and the Criminal Division. We want to try and keep the things going relatively quickly today and cut off the tops of the mountains rather than get down in the detail. The committee all has committee binders in regard to some of the detail that they can read and continue to delve into some degree. Though I don't want to quell questions, I do want to hit the tops of the mountains and keep on bouncing forward. So, with the indulgence of the committee, we'll continue. Catherine Cope, is that how you pronounce it?
That's correct.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Chair Patridge, members of the committee, my name is Cynthia Koch. I'm the captain of the Fish and Wildlife Division of the Oregon State Police. I'm here today to give you a program overview of the Fish and Wildlife Division, and I understand from your instructions and others that it's time to cut to the chase a little bit. I'll watch your body language if I'm taking too long, and answer your questions if I've skipped over things too quickly. Fish and Wildlife Division has been in existence since 1931 when legislature created the Oregon State Police and decided that fish and wildlife enforcement need to be handled out of a law enforcement agency rather than a fish and wildlife management agency. It's important to note that the Oregon State Police Fish and Wildlife Division is the only state entity in state government that does enforce the fish and wildlife enforcement. We have that responsibility. Just briefly, as a major component of our program, we have developed a process called cooperative enforcement planning, which is in accordance with other natural resource agencies, particularly Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. This is a method in which we determine, with the help of biologists and other members of the natural resource community and citizens, to determine what are priorities. It's in this process where we rank fish and wildlife resource priorities in order of high, medium, and low. We write action plans to address priorities and then evaluate them later on down the road. The Fish and Wildlife Division is divided into two sections at this time. There's a fishery section and a wildlife section, and some of that's probably self-explanatory in the notebook. It tells the different things that we do enforce with ORS and OAR authority. The purpose of the fisheries section obviously is to enforce all commercial and sport fishing laws in the state, dealing with anything from license and permits to harvest monitoring and vessel inspections. The wildlife section on the reverse side of that coin handles both the wildlife issues in the state, as well as they also support our Marine Board enforcement program. They also manage the wildlife enforcement decoy program, the turn-in-a-poacher program, as well as our big game enforcement. Although no longer a section, the division still does have four planes and pilots. They support both fish and wildlife enforcement as well as ODFW flights to support management for their biological studies. We also support other divisions of our state police and sometimes other agencies. Two other components I'd like to mention of the Fish and Wildlife Division are we have an individual who is assigned to environmental crimes enforcement with the Department of Environmental Quality up in Portland, and we have a small unit called the Special Investigations Unit, which investigates long-term and rather complex fish and wildlife issues. There's an org chart, and I think maybe it's at the end of yours. It's in the middle of mine, but it does show where we come out of the Central Operations Command and shows how our personnel is divided between three regions and our Special Investigations Unit. Service is delivered through many different ways other than just primarily fish and wildlife enforcement. We also are responsible for backcountry emergency locates, lost hunter and angler assistance. We do a lot of public talks, motorist assists, hunter education, and many other things that are listed again in your notebook.
Program's okay.
Okay, program it is then. It's important to note that with Fish and Wildlife officers, not only are they enforcing Fish and Wildlife rules, but they're also tasked with handling all criminal traffic and any other issue that comes their way. It's kind of, we like to think of it as the full meal deal there. There are many factors, obviously, that are going to affect service delivery in Oregon. Some are environmental, some are societal, and obviously some are financial. We are seeing all those things being taxed recently, but Fish and Wildlife enforcement is necessary to create accountability that requires these important law enforcement services. We are currently seeing numbers of protected and endangered species of wildlife continue to rise, as well as most recent on the landscape seems to be groundfish species of a lot of concern. And currently there are petitions that are listing their protection that are under review. These are areas that are somewhat new to us and do deem some kind of law enforcement from the Fish and Wildlife Division. I have included our performance measure. Again, I think it's more toward the back, but our officers, they record their time by species that is being protected and relationship to what water body or what hunt unit they are operating and working in. All this information is then tabulated. We keep extremely good statistics on how much time and how much protection is given to each species. We're able to then take that information and develop a performance measure, which we did this time, having to do with the protection of salmon and steelhead. And included in our performance measure, a very important component is voluntary compliance, and that is what we do measure in our performance measure. One of the aspects that the Fish and Wildlife Division, I think, is very good at, and that is at cooperative enforcement. We do meet with lots of different agencies. We try to conjoin with them to do cooperative patrols, whether it's through our Marine Board enforcement with county deputies and covering and saturating well-used water bodies, and vice versa, letting them know what our patrol schedules are so that we don't oversaturate an area. We do the same with the Coast Guard, where we join them in ocean patrols. And our officers, there are 13 of them that are assigned right now specifically to Oregon plan duties, also work with the natural resource agencies, whether it's WRD or DSL and DEQ, to make sure that the mission gets done all in one.
Senator George.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. When you mentioned the endangered species, I went back and I looked at federal funds and saw there was a 230% increase. Is that primarily those federal dollars coming in because of Endangered Species Act enforcement activities?
No, I think that the money that you're referring to in federal funds is just budget authority.
Pardon? The National Fisheries Grant.
Oh, the National Marine. But that, again, is just authority to those are not funds that we have received. We have been working on a action plan. Am I wrong on this? Okay. We're working on trying to put together a joint enforcement, action plan, but it has not been solidified at this time.
But is it related to the endangered species activity? Is that the reason there's potential for that much money?
Chair Patridge, Senator George, no, it's really more to address the commercial fisheries and fisheries on the ocean and in the Columbia.
Go ahead and proceed.
Okay, and I'll do a little bit more follow-up for you so that we're straight on that. I just have a little bit more here to talk about cost management and I pretty much covered that. How we manage one way is through the use of our itineraries. Our Fish and Wildlife officers, instead of being on a regular 5-8 or 4-10 schedule, they're able to address Fish and Wildlife priorities by flexing their schedule and being able to work either split shift or longer than 8 hours, longer than 10 or 12 hours at times. We also take care of our vehicles and boats and make sure we get the maximum service life out of those.
Okay. I have a question for you when we're talking personnel. My understanding is that there was some bumping that occurred as a result of the budget cuts that occurred. What kind of specialized training, and I asked this yesterday too, the same kind of question, what kind of specialized training do your people go through and how much does it cost? You don't have to answer that for me right now, but I would like you to follow up to let us know how much the specialized training costs. I'd also like to know from the department, you know, you've had these, my understanding is you have a lot of specialized ODFMW monies that you use to do your Fish and Wildlife Enforcement Division officers. They're trained specifically. They've been out in the field. They've been in these areas, and then as a result of the bumping, we've had to move some of those people out and put in less trained people. I'd like to know what your statutory and contractual restrictions are as to your bumping process in terms of how you work that, so that we can maybe take a look at those things, because I know we shifted a lot of these people over, but by the same token, they're not trained. So that's, I know that that's been an issue for a lot of jurisdictions who rely very heavily on these particular officers.
Mr. Chair, another sort of related issue, a lot, and I think when the cap and I talked a few months ago, one of the issues was that a lot of the newer Fish and Wildlife people are getting biology degrees or some kind of
science degrees
around the field prior to going into trooper training. And that's another thing. Those are the younger officers. They're less seniority, and that's another sort of expertise you're losing through this process.
Well, I just want to know if there's any basically, I want to know if there's any statutory restrictions from you guys as part of your collective bargaining when you do this next time to be able to really prioritize where these people are. I don't want to mess up the collective bargaining process to any great degree in regards to this. By the same token, I don't know if there's statutory limitations in your ability to be able to, and impediments in terms of your ability to put the right trained people in the right area. Bill, did you want to?
Chair, I think what you're referring to is when we laid off troopers this last February 1st, the Fish and Wildlife Division had 25 troopers who were within the 129 that were laid off. And we had funding for those positions, and so we had to fill them with officers who had not been in Fish and Wildlife Enforcement, and so they were taken out of their current position. And that was a matter of the collective bargaining agreement.
Yeah, and I was aware of it. I think
right.
The committee, to some degree, is aware of that. And my question is there any statutory impediment to your ability to negotiate a collective bargaining contract whereby you could keep your trained personnel, especially when they're highly specialized in various areas, without having to go through the, you know, you could do your bump rotation in that process, but, you know, your ODFMW or your fish and game officers are much differently trained than as opposed to your normal troopers on the ground.
Appreciate the question, and I will. It's a little beyond my area of expertise.
No,
right,
I understand
we'll
that. That's why
now.
I said you don't have to answer the question now.
Right. And with that,
Representative Hansen could probably tell me the answer.
Pardon?
You could probably tell me the answer, but I don't know.
Well, I think it's just a basic labor management issue. In a lot of work organizations, you have split boards where you have separate seniority rights. Based on different types of expertise, and that's something that gets negotiated usually through the collective bargaining. The other one that I've seen in some areas, you've got people have bumping rights, but in order to exercise those, they have to keep up with the skills and training level in order to be able to bump into those jobs. And that may end up being a factor, but probably since neither of those were occurring at this time, it's probably worked out according to the way their contract read.
I'm sure it probably did. So just put that as a budget note, potentially as a budget note to ask that as the governor continues to proceed, that maybe we send that in as a budget note. So we want to look at that, and we'll determine that as we move to the next session. All right. Continue. Bill, are you ready?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead, Bill.
For the record, Bill McGee from the Department of Administrative Services Budget Management Division. We'll start with the numbers for the Fish and Wildlife Division. The general fund, the governor's budget, is just under $4 million. lottery funds, just over $14,300,000 approximately for other funds, and slightly under $1 million for federal funds. Overall, it's significant reductions in general fund, but increases in most of the other fund types. Page 3 shows you just the graphical description of where the dollars come from. This division is largely other-funded. As I think you've heard in the conversation, revenues transferred from the Department of Fish and Wildlife, from the Marine Board, a little bit from the Parks Department. Federal funds are primarily from the National Marine Fisheries Service grant limitation, and then a small amount from the Corps of Engineers. Lottery funds entirely about Measure 66, and then the remaining 16% general fund. The major changes through the special sessions for this division were the cancellation of the recruit school, which eliminated 3 officers, but also a restoration of 3 sworn positions with additional Measure 66 lottery funds during the second special session. There were 6 additional sworn positions eliminated in House Bill 5100 in the 5th special session, and of course the compensation increases were funded at 75%. The governor's budget, the highlights of that were an elimination of 6 additional sworn positions due to Measure 66, lottery funds, and ODFW, other funds issues. Restoration of 3 sworn positions with an increase from Department of Fish and Wildlife dollars in anticipation of a fee increase, which they have proposed, and an increased transfer from the Marine Board, and finally the grant limitation from the National Marine Fisheries Service. Page 5 shows you the category distribution, total funds there. Personal services is 79%. You see capital outlay here is 7%, and that's primarily because of the designation in ballot measure 66 that a certain percentage of those dollars go to capital for boats or cars or whatever equipment is appropriate there. The next page shows you general fund, and you see capital outlay drops just about 0. Otherwise, the service and supplies, personal services are kind of in the same proportion to each other, with that exception. Walking you through the development of the governor's budget, starting at $4.8 million general fund, $4.7 lottery, and total $23.6 total funds. Again, the emergency board was the National Marine Fisheries Services grant for $100,000 that went for boats, some additional officer time and water, and some support for the division in as well. Second special session, as we talked about, eliminated 3 positions with the January 2000 recruit school and restored 3 positions with lottery funds. So, in essence, a kind of a backfill there. Base budget adjustments, again, the standard personnel and compensation increases from 2001-03 rolled forward, and the cost of the 2003-05 step increases that you'll remove from the budget during your work session. On page 8, go through the essential packages. Package 10, the vacancy savings on fixed personal services, about $200,000 general fund and $284,000 total fund. Phase in, phase outs here were, again, the shift of the officers from the general fund to the lottery funds that occurred in the second special session. The phase out of the first $100,000 from the Marine Fisheries Service grant that was approved in the E-Board, and the phase out of an incentive pay adjustment. Inflation, state government service charges, just your base inflation issues, a small amount of other funds and lottery funds. State government service charge here, the tort issue is not a significant issue here, so it's sort of kind of general levels of state government service charge, you can see. Package 70, the revenue reductions reduced $396,000 lottery funds, $1,000,001 other funds, 9 positions, and 9 FTE. The other funds issues were shortfalls in the transfer from the Department of Fish and Wildlife and the Marine Board. The lottery fund issue was, just to clarify and add a little bit to what responded to Senator George's question yesterday, there's even though the lottery dollars are up here, with the increased cost of compensation, with the shift of 3 officers in a special session, there wasn't enough money to continue the full cost of all the officers that had been established. So as a result, we had to make about a $400,000 lottery fund reduction and eliminate 3 positions there. Third special session, package 81, just again the elimination for the cost of living increase for salary range 38 and above. Fifth special session, the specified reductions were just about $80,000 general fund service and supplies reductions. Package 83, the emergency fund rebalance, the effect of that for this division was a reduction of general fund where overtime, salary differential, service and supplies, and capital outlay amounts were transferred out and transferred into other divisions. Package 91, the unspecified 5100 reductions were $861,000 general fund, elimination of 6 positions, And those roll-ups were carried forward in VO305 biennium. Beginning the unique policy packages for this division in package 110, this package creates six positions and 4.07 FTE with no dollars attached. What happens here is that we've shifted funds from the temporary appointments account to salaries and benefits so that six part-time limited duration positions could be established for temporary assignments. And that's partly a technical issue. It's partly an issue of how we are able to employ temporaries. You can't have temporaries on for extended periods of time, we don't have some position for them. So that was done with no additional dollars. Package 111, a fund shift, increasing the budget $463,000, other funds, three positions. Those are three positions that are being restored from Package 70 with the proposed fee increase from the on fishing and hunting licenses and House Bill 2260 proposed by the Department of Fish and Wildlife, and an increased transfer from the Marine Board. And that restored three positions. Last package, 112, that's the federal fund grant, assuming additional funding from the National Marine Fisheries Service for patrol hours, computer support, boats, and other equipment. And the estimate at the time the budget was put together would be about $635,500. There are no direct fee or revenue changes for this department other than the Fish and Wildlife Department's fee increase. It's just a couple of technical adjustments that would increase the budget, this division's budget by $12,000 general fund and reduce lottery funds by $102,233. Again, there's an adjustment of personal services estimates. Once we actually loaded the positions in and found out what the real costs were, we just corrected our estimates. And there's a very technical issue about being able to have positions in more than one package. We can't do that, so we had to switch some money between packages in a kind of a zero sum. And the end result of that, again, is for this division, an additional $12,000 general fund and a reduction of $102,000 lottery funds. And that's all I have for this division.
Where does the lottery funds come from?
Those are all
Measure
66. Yeah, all dedicated Measure 66.
So they're all dedicated Measure 66?
General fund is just general fund appropriations,
right.
And all the other funds come from the fees, predominantly Marine Corps.
In this division, it's either fees or contracts with other departments.
Okay. Yeah.
Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Koch, the National Marine Board, or National Marine Fisheries Service, those positions, grant funds, policy package 112, are those some of the seasonal positions that you use for counting fish and those kinds of things?
Chair Patrick, Representative Butler, no. We don't employ people to count fish. I think you might be thinking about people who work for ODFW.
Okay. What are the seasonal positions that are taken care of? Or
Marine Patrol?
Yeah. Is that what the seasonal positions are? Is that Marine Patrol?
Do you mean the temporary positions in 110?
Well, in looking at the organization chart, you've got seasonal positions 29, 11.8 FTE.
Okay. Chair Patridge, Representative Butler, now I know what you're referring to. Those seasonal positions are, they were our cadet program, and they were also limitation that allowed us to hire back retirees to do contract work for ODFW, but they were all in an enforcement capacity.
And so they were during hunting season, fishing season, those kinds of things.
Representative Butler, that's correct. Yes.
Okay, follow up, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
When we've gone from 167 positions to 136 positions. 31 position reduction over the last couple of years. Is there some excess equipment that's occasioned by this cutback in the force?
Chair Patridge, Representative Butler, sometimes there is. We really haven't seen a lot of excess currently right now. When we did, we do have eight fewer positions. There are probably eight pickups out there. What we've been able to do, however, with that excess equipment is that's been able to be used for those seasonal positions that you're referring to, and so we don't have to go out and buy more vehicles. It's been able to kind of subsidize that program.
Okay. Continue on this.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the fifth special session, there was the reduction in general fund of $80,162, and that was used to reduce services and supplies. Got a lot of vehicles out there. Tell me what you're doing with regard to the increase in the price of fuel.
Chair Patridge, Representative Butler, I'm not quite sure I understand the question. I guess we have fewer vehicles out there being used, and the price of fuel, I guess it's not quite an issue that the department as a whole has actually addressed yet.
Mr. Chair, if I understood what Ms. Koch said, was that they kept all the equipment, so you kept all the equipment, still have all the equipment that you had before, and you got $80,000 less funding as a result of the package, and at least last time I checked, fuel price was up and probably continues up. You know, at some point, the department's going to have to come to the stark realization that you can't keep all that equipment operating at the same price that you were able to operate when fuel was $1.30 a gallon.
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, for the record, Danny Bisgard, Budget Director. In the third special session, we did cut S&S. Basically, the strategy of the department was we cut that to try to save positions in fish and wildlife that we needed for...
What'd you cut, Danny? That's what I'm looking for here.
It would have been other S&S, training, out-of-state travel. I can get you the specific cuts in those line items. I didn't bring that list with me, but yes, sir, that's what we did on the general fund side. To refer to your question on gasoline, you're absolutely correct. We're watching the pump prices as well. I will share with you, we were budgeted $1.23 a gallon. Remember, we don't pay the federal estate taxes. Right now, we're $1.25 with reports. Remember, our reports come in after the fact. They're late. They're November, December reports right now. Obviously, it's going up. I've got staff right now trying to check with our fuel folks to see what the estimates might be between now and the rest of the biennia. The budget with us at $1.23 with a 3.5% inflation that we're allowed next biennium is about $1.27. And so from the discussion yesterday and what we're monitoring here, we'll put some figures together, as Mr. McGee referenced also. I don't have the exact figure of what they will be as these change. We know we have a problem. We figure about a penny an increased gallon of gasoline is about $24,000 problem a biennia for each penny increase. And so we will be taking a look at that and see what that's impact for the rest of this biennium as well as future biennium, depending upon what happens with this gas. But you're absolutely correct. S&S was reduced in the third special session. I will share with you as well that we do use our measure $66, which are lottery dollars, for the equipment needs of this agency. The general fund capital outlay in this budget is basically nil. We're using Measure $66, which we can, the capital portion of Measure 66 to take care of equipment, whether it's a Fish and Wildlife officer, whether it's Measure 66 or a general funded officer to take care of the needs of the agency. We do run our fleet, as you heard from Patrol, and you haven't heard from Cindy, but we do run our fleets pretty long. Patrol cars over 120,000, so we're stretching as much as we can. In Fish and Wildlife, pickups take a little more abuse, 95,000, but they also go as high as 120,000. Some of those aren't turned over very quickly. We hold them for our seasonal people, so they have a rig so they can get from point A to point B during the seasons.
Mr. Chair, we've got less than 0.5% capital outlay in this budget, so we're going to be obviously putting on a lot more miles on these vehicles. And the concern I've got is not just the additional cost of maintaining and operating those, the long-term cost of replacement as well, but the current operating and maintaining as a result of zero replacement and much higher operating costs could knock us totally out of the water. I don't want to see these folks on bicycles necessarily. Now, Mr. Chair, I had one final question, and it came in the form of the questions that Doug had passed out to the agency, and that is, I'd like to know what these folks are doing, where they're assigned, and whether or not any of them are assigned and distant duty posts. I know that this current governor may not have the same propensity to use these particular officers in other places like maybe our past governor was wont to do, but my concern is that I don't want to see a batch of highly trained, very efficient folks siphoned off to another non-ODF&W or Fish and Wildlife Division utilization where we could get the highest, best use out of them. So, Doug, this goes with this entire division. I'd like to know where these folks are at, what their duties are. If necessary, you know, have them tell us what their duties are. And I am concerned where they're assigned. Not the only ones that I'm concerned about here are that we don't maintain our own Air Force pilots in this process to take folks on fishing trips and so forth. That is of concern to me. That is sincerely a concern to me that we know where these folks are assigned to and from, and then I would like to know that assigned duty post for the show up in the morning for these folks is an OSP assigned duty post, that it doesn't start at a courthouse somewhere or in someone's office where we really don't know that they're going to start the day. And I guess maybe the question is, where do you start and end your day relative to your assigned post? And if that's from a duty station in rural Oregon or in Salem or Albany or somewhere else, that's fine for those folks that are on the road. I just like to know where all of our officers are at, because I got a sneaking suspicion from what I've been told by other people that some of these folks are not where we would like to see some of our assigned posts people to be at the prices that we're paying for them. So I need that information.
Senator George.
Well, that brings up an issue too, and that's back to the aircraft again. We have four aircraft in this division. And what I can remember a few years ago when we went out to examine the fleet at that time, which was substantially a larger number of aircraft, that I asked one of the pilots how many hours did you fly per year, and was given a number. And I said, well, what do you do when you're not flying? Do you get into a patrol car? Do you go out and do other things? The answer was no. So I would like to know, I'd like to have a handle on the four or five pilots. What do they do if they're not in the aircraft? How many hours are you actually flying? Are we maintaining? I don't think we maintain this fleet like forestry maintains their own aircraft. So that would be good to know that.
Chair Patridge, Senator George, I can provide that documentation for you. I will give you a written document that has it on there, but just briefly speaking, of our four pilots that we have, they ranged anywhere from just under 500 flight hours to over 900 flight hours. And all of them are assigned a patrol vehicle, a pickup, to do game work, and they all report to a supervisor in either Baker City, Bend, Central Point, or Salem, and do fish and wildlife work when they're not either flying or doing maintenance on their aircraft.
Thank you.
Any further questions?
Boy, that blew me out of the water. Maintenance? These are the maintenance folks for our aircraft?
Captain Cove,
I didn't catch
Representative them. Butler said, was wondering if they were doing the maintenance on the aircrafts as well.
Representative Patridge, Representative Butler, maintenance might be having to take their plane to a place to have the maintenance actually done, whether they're putting a new engine in or having the oil changed. Some of that cannot be done where they are. They have to go to another location. It may be keeping the aircraft clean. There's a
cleaning?
List of...
Cleaning?
Clean.
Mr. Chair, I'm... This is really going to be tough for me to swallow. These folks, if we've got to pay state trooper fare in order to keep these airplanes clean, or to do the A&P mechanic business, or to drop them off. I mean, most of them are big enough airports that there's a mechanic present, I would think. But I just am very, very concerned. And Senator George has brought up a good point, and that is the concern. If they're assigned to pick up and they've got duties when they're not flying, that's perfectly fine. My concern is they shouldn't be doing A&P mechanic work. They shouldn't be doing cleaning work. That's probably work that we could have subbed out for somebody at a little over minimum wage. And the A&P mechanics, I hope we're not having troopers doing A&P mechanic work on these planes. Without proper certification and those kinds of things too. So,
Captain Koch, do you want to respond to that, or you want to respond later?
Chair Patridge, Representative Butler, I don't want to give the wrong impression that these people are they're responsible for their aircraft, and part of them, and they take a personal pride in making sure that their aircraft is running smoothly. It's the only one up there, and if something goes wrong, obviously it's a little different than having a flat tire on the road. And I believe we built accountability into our aircraft program to ensure that these people are doing productive police work when they're not flying. Or seeing that their aircraft is being taken care of.
Well, Mr. Chair, my concern is that when they're done using it for a special fish and wildlife specific purpose, and people have crawled in with muddy boots and dirty this and that and the other, that when we bring it back into the airport, that officer is able to go ahead and log back out of the aircraft and turn the aircraft over for its regular hourly checks and maintenance and those kinds of things, and that we have other folks that are specialized trained ground crews that can go in and pick up dirty linen or whatever off the floors of these particular aircraft. The voters and the people of the state of Oregon have said we'd like to have more of those troopers out there in the fields, worried about the true fish and wildlife issues and game enforcement issues that we've got. I think it's a dereliction of duty if we say, I'm sorry, we really can't have those folks out in the field because they're scrubbing the windows of an airplane today. I think that's wrong. Or they're waiting for the airplane to get worked on at an airport where they have their vehicle ready to take them to another duty post anyway. So I just want to make absolutely certain that if they're only flying 600 to 900 hours, that the remaining a portion of the 2,000 hours of the year that we expect those folks to be working for us, that they are doing the kinds of things that they are specially trained to do. And that brings up the other issue. If they're working 900 hours in an airplane, these are folks that are specially highly trained in fish and wildlife issues. Are they spending the rest of their time in training and really not putting any of that time on the road? And that would be an important part of what their responsibilities are. So, because I know that you spend an officer, I think the last I'd heard was that one of these officers would spend about 1,000 hours actually working on the road, working in the field, and then the other 1,000 hours was the paperwork, was the training, was the traveling to and from. So, I mean, we've got a lot of very expensive overhead in those folks, and so I'd want to know that the training time that put it on these folks, if they can't spend their time in fish and wildlife pursuits, that there maybe their training time should be better spent just doing regular road patrol. So, just a question. Thank you. I'm done.
Okay.
Got off that soapbox.
Anything further?
Okay, are we ready to go further? I don't have any more response to what the representative said, if that's your ask. Staffing of the Fish and Wildlife Division has remained fairly static for the last 20 or 25 years. It stayed in the early, or in the 124. In 1999, the legislature increased to an all-time high of 128 officers, but we were never actually able to see that many officers in Fish and Wildlife Enforcement due to some other issues. In 2001, we were cut 8 positions, bringing us to 120, and then this year we've seen another additional reduction of 8 positions, which Bill spoke about earlier. I currently have 110 officers, including myself. We have one administrative staff person who works at headquarters, and then I have one empty position as well. Certainly things that Representative Butler has brought up today are cost factors, such as the cost of vehicles and cost of gasoline and other equipment that we have to be concerned with. Other things that may push our costs up are training, as well as possibly having to relocate members to where the work actually is. We have looked at costs of Fish and Wildlife Division members, and on a statewide basis, there's really nothing to compare with because there's no other agency that provides this service. in the state of Oregon. However, we did compare with the other western states and found that some pay more, some pay less. We're about in the middle of the road. I think I've already talked about the performance measure and the essential packages is what Mr. McGee spoke of. Our budget reductions are listed, 6 in the general fund, 3 in lottery, and 3 in ODFW funded. I've listed those locations where they would be. I guess the last thing I have to add is it's a real tough for me to say that I can provide effective enforcement and protection of fish and wildlife resources with the number of people that we're dwindling down to with the loss of the general fund. Those are monies that go toward the commercial fish program, certainly to other enforcement issues besides fish and wildlife and other things I think have already been mentioned.
Captain Cook, I have a couple questions for you. One, I'd also be interested in how many troopers you'd need or how many sworn officers you'd need to cover the same area that you cover by the utilization of the airplane fleet that you have in terms of, I assume that you would have to have more ground officers on the ground to cover some of those similar areas. So I'm interested in what that would look like if we were to eliminate the planes and still provide the kind of coverage that we would need. In addition, I'm also interested to know if we were to reduce the number of officers equivalent to where we were at the general fund, if there would be any federal dollars or other federal laws that we might transgress as a result of our inability to properly enforce federal law in regards to endangered species or any of those types of actions as a state. I don't know whether that is the case or is not the case. I just merely raised the question.
Mr. Chair, currently I'm not aware of any, but we'll get back to you on that as well.
If it puts federal funding at risk for coastal stuff or any of those kinds of things, if we're not properly enforced, I'm interested in that kind of those kinds of questions.
Okay. Anything further?
That's what I had today.
Thank you, mm-hmm. Captain. We certainly appreciate you being here. Gaming division's next. Welcome, Captain Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name's Bob Miller. I hope to give you a very brief overview of who we are and what we do and what's going on within the state, and then answer any questions that you might have. The Gaming Enforcement Division is made up of the Lottery Security Section, the Tribal Gaming Section, and the Oregon Boxing and Wrestling Commission. And what the lottery does is we've got personnel strategically located around the state that provide day-to-day services to the commission. These include the main activities we do is conduct retailer, employee, and vendor investigations. That takes the majority of our time. We provide physical security for the lottery facilities, mainly the facility here in Salem. We conduct criminal investigations on crimes committed against the lottery, and we assist lottery staff with providing information systems security for the lottery computer system and the lottery games. And we assist local law enforcement with investigations relative to crimes at retailer establishments.
Regarding the lottery, how many of those people are housed within OSP facilities as opposed to the Lottery Commission office?
We have, I believe, Mr. Chair, we have 7 in Portland. We have, everybody that's not in Salem is housed in an OSP facility.
How many people are housed at the lottery?
We have 6 detectives and 4 managers.
10 people. You have half at here in Salem at the lottery, housed at the lottery.
That's correct.
And why is the choice for state police to house them at the lottery? They don't typically house your other agencies, like the agency or the division that was just before us, at the facility as opposed to within the OSP structure.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, I didn't catch part of that.
At the typically, you get even if you provide services like you provide fish and wildlife services, and you get Measure 66 money, you get all this other money. Those
patrol officers, or those officers are not necessarily housed at the agency that provides the money. Why have you chosen to do that differently with this particular, with sending 10 people over at the lottery?
All right, Mr. Chair, the reason is that much of what goes on in Salem is a service that goes on at the lottery. The testing of the games, the state police is required to test all new games, scratch it, break open, to make sure that they meet the security requirements.
But none of those are unique to necessarily being placed at the lottery facility.
Other than that's where the games come into, and security of transporting the games from point A to point B. We have a small lab at the lottery where we do that testing. Player services, where people come in to claim tickets. We check, we do validations. We're required to do validations on prizes of over $600. We're required to do a fairly extensive validation on prizes of over $5,000. And so those folks come into player services, and so we're on staff on location to deal with those as people come in. There's also work that we have to do in the mailroom. There's certain prizes that and tickets that come in through the mailroom, and by rule out there, a state police employee has to be present when all the mail's opened up.
You're paying an officer to open the mail at the lottery?
No, we're paying an officer to be there and validate tickets as they come in.
And whose rule is that?
That's an Oregon lottery rule, sir.
And where did they get their authority and statute to do that?
Through the rulemaking authority and state statute.
Okay. We should probably take a look at that.
I have a training question, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much, if I may. These are unique, obviously, to these positions, Captain. So my concern is, are these officers regularly sent back for lots of continuing education, lots of continued schooling, and those kinds of updates and upgrades and those kinds of things, like the rest of the officers that we expect that would be handling game violations or patrol violations, those kinds of things? Or are these officers going to dedicate, by preponderance, a large majority of their time and not have to be retrained? I mean, retraining watching the mailroom, or retraining, how to sample a scratch-off as to whether or not it's a true scratch-off versus a fake scratch-off. I personally am aghast that we'd be paying the kind of wages that we have to for OSP to do that kind of an issue. But what amount of training are they spending out of the 2,000-plus hour a year?
Right, Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, if I understand your question correctly, the detectives that are assigned to the lottery security section are required to do all the same mandatory training as any state police officer: firearms, self-defense, first responder, hazardous materials, all those sorts of things. In addition to that, they receive specialized training mainly on-the-job training or in-house training at the lottery on lottery rules, statutes. There's a wide variety of games that come through the lottery that they have to stay up on.
Can you give me some idea of how much additional time? Now, again, having worked with some members of the OSP in years past, they've kind of used a rule that and this is more highway patrol than anything else, that if there are 1,000 hours on highway patrol, then there are 1,000 hours somewhere else, whether it's in a courtroom or whether it's being retrained or in process of transit for retraining and those kinds of things. So can you give me some idea as to how many additional hours these folks, after they're retrained in the use of the firearms and retrained in the use of hazardous materials and retrained how to do dodge and attack in their car and those kinds of things, can you give me some idea how much additional time is then used by these officers and training in new techniques for the lottery issues that are specific to the lottery and checking for the correct scratch-off and those kinds of things?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, I can't give you a definitive number. I spent the majority of my career in the criminal division, and I can tell you from my observations, and I manage by walking around a lot, I'm around these folks a lot, the training requirements at the lottery are a lot less than they are for a general law detective to stay up on things. And I think, Representative Butler, that's because it's such a dynamic, evolving industry that they're on top of this all the time. They're learning all the time as a part of their job.
But they're doing that in addition to all of the standard training that's required for an officer, as if he or she were on other duty to be responsible to take care of road patrol or other kinds of patrol activities.
Can I interrupt you for a second? I think what we should ask the state police for is by division how much time they're able to spend on the road versus how much time they're able to spend in training.
That's a good idea, and then additional training too.
You're not spinning the wheels. You're asking a legitimate question in terms of how much time they're spending on the road versus how much time are really, how much time they're doing enforcement, I guess is probably a better term, versus how much time they're spending in training, transit. Well, don't want to say non-productive time, but
no,
not in non-enforcement time. Is that a fair way? Is that all right?
Yes,
Danny,
yes.
Is that something that...
Mr. Chair, we can do that.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Chair, as far as tribal gaming, there are 9 federally recognized tribes in Oregon. All 9 have gaming compacts with the state that they've negotiated. 9 out of the 8 tribes have casinos and have been operating those for several years now. These agreements that the tribes and state have negotiated require the state police to perform 4 primary functions. These include independent investigations and review of certain gaming license applications to determine suitability for a gaming license, independent investigation of gaming vendors, financiers, and management officials, independent monitoring and oversight of each tribal gaming casino conducted for the purpose of confirming compact compliance, and conducting independent regulatory and gaming-related criminal investigations to include any incidents of compact violations. Now, in addition to that, the state police is the eyes and ears of the state, the governor's office, for ensuring that all provisions of the compact are complied with, and this includes non-regulatory provisions as well. To the Boxing and Wrestling Commission, the Boxing and Wrestling Commission was created by the Oregon Legislature in 1987. It was assigned to the Oregon State Police in 1993. They look after the state's interests, the participants' interests, and the general public by establishing and enforcing medical and safety standards, qualifying officials, and designating ringside positions. Preventing the financial exploitation of participants by enforcing contracts and financial obligations of promoters, and investigating all alleged violations of statutes and rules applying to boxing and wrestling in the state, coordinating with other state commissions and law enforcement agencies, and upon request and by written agreement, we provide services to Oregon tribal governments as well.
Senator George.
A few years ago, we were dealing with this issue to a great extent. And, of course, one of the issues that I was asking at the time is how many events do we have going that are occurring in the state?
Right.
And folks that were in the industry were saying, look, where these are orchestrated, planned events, we should be maybe viewed a little bit differently than how we were treating them. And we've had made great progress. But I'm now hearing the complaints again. Can you guys get for us the numbers of all the different kinds of events, boxing and wrestling, and then particularly where we have the, what is the proper word? I mean, use the word orchestrated, but it's rehearsed, I guess.
Choreographed,
yeah. Events.
Mr. Chair, Senator George, I remember our previous conversation as well. If I could update you real quickly, so far this biennium we've had 15 professional boxing or wrestling events in the state. Oregon is getting back on the map. We had the Roy Jones Jr. World Championship fights up at the Rose Garden. Golden Boy Productions, which is Oscar De La Hoya, has been having fights at the Rose Garden on about a quarterly basis. And so out of that 8 were professional boxing, 7 were professional wrestling. Wrestling always seems for some reason to be kind of the bugaboo in this whole business. And Senator George, I'm confident in sitting here today telling you that next time we get together, this is going to be a non-issue. The commission has been, this recently surfaced with WB Television up in Portland. Right on the heels of that, we've drafted some new Oregon administrative rules. I met with Representative Smith and her staff yesterday. Had some calls with Jay Isaacs from the Rose Garden this morning. We're well on our way to resolving, I think, hopefully forever, the perceived impediments of bringing folks like WWE to Oregon and some of these sorts of things. So you should hear a lot less from your constituency in the near future, and we're trying to get on top of that. Commission doesn't like the controversy surrounding this area as well, and I think we're well on our way to solving that.
And I'm sure we didn't change the statute that says we're supposed to be overseeing an industry,
right,
and promoting the well-being of that industry too. So I know there has to be a balance there, and I appreciate how much progress we've made so far.
Thanks. Mr. Chair, on the performance measures, because of the nature of our division, especially the gaming aspects of lottery and the tribal gaming, our performance measures are tied to either contract rule obligations or the obligations that were put upon the state in the compacts. And these have to do with certain things being done within certain time frames, mainly the investigations. And so that's how we measure the success of what we do, is in meeting either our rule or our compact obligations. Now, in the boxing and wrestling arena, it's geared more toward keeping track of being proactive in ensuring the safety of the industry. This involves on-site testing, random drug tests, in-field licensing type of contact. So that's where we devote our energies.
Okay.
As far as what's going on within the state, the lottery things, we've got increases in temporary contracts, in retailer investigations and retailer inspections. But because of some of the streamlining that we've done on how we do business and some of the reporting requirements, to date, we've been able to keep up with those increases, and trying to project out into the coming biennium, I still think that we can do it with existing staff. Now, in tribal gaming is always a tough, it's still evolving. For example, right now in tribal gaming, we have 4,538, or we had 4,538 machines last biennium. That number has increased to 5,245. That's how many are currently on the floor in your tribal casinos, but that number could go up without any agreement by the state to almost 6,928. We've gone from 114 to 131 table games, blackjack, pie gal, roulette, craps. That number could actually go to 343. Now, these numbers are important to me because every machine, every table that goes up requires more monitoring, more validation type of activities by our staff. Now, I expect that with the current increase, we'll still be able to cover that with existing staff. Two bienniums ago, we were 21 people. Last biennium, we were 18. We're at 16 now. I think we're at a bare bones. The reason I haven't come in and asked for more people is I've got agreement from the tribes that should certain things happen, that they will join me at the table at the emergency board and ask for additional personnel to conducting oversight monitoring activities at their casinos. couple of things that are going on in Indian country that are of interest is the state is currently in litigation with the Coos tribe, the only non-gaming tribe in the state, over a possible casino in Florence. Should the tribe prevail in that litigation, they anticipate building a casino in Florence during the 2003-05 biennium. Warm Springs is in talks with the governor at this time regarding moving their casino. Now, they have the second smallest casino in the state. If they move it to either one or the three locations that they're talking about, they have the potential of being the largest casino in the state. Should those things occur, I may be coming back at some future point to ask for additional personnel. Alan, since I did my written testimony, the Grand Ronde tribe has made an offer to build a casino in Portland.
Should all well aware.
Oh, yeah. Should that occur, it has the potential, the rumors I get from my contacts out at Spirit Mountain and other places is that the plan would be that it would be at least twice as big as Grand Ronde currently is, which is the largest casino in the state. That would shift a tremendous workload, especially during the ramp-up time for that casino. Again, we'd have to come back to the legislature and ask for additional
resources. I anticipate that you will be coming back if one of those things happens.
Yes.
Anything further? Representative Hanson.
Well, a couple questions. I had a chance to look over the budget that I'm assuming you had prepared for the lottery commission. There was a breakdown of the expenses over the last two biennium. There were a couple questions that came on my mind on that, and I'm sorry I don't have it with me right now. But one was a decrease of you had budgeted for this biennium $112,000 for out-of-state travel, and you hadn't spent any. And I'm wondering if that was because of, like, governor's ban on what? Why was the money budgeted and then not used? Is the governor's ban on out-of-state travel, or?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hanson, we spent money, and actually, I don't have that figure with me, but substantially more than $11 or whatever that occurs on that thing. Those expenses are
$112,000 was what was budgeted,
right?
But no money. But the sheet I saw showed no money was spent.
And that's because those costs have been picked up on the lottery side.
Well, this was the lottery side. I'm just looking at your. That was just your budget.
Right, Mr. Chair.
From the lottery commission.
Right, Mr. Chair, Representative Hanson. What happens at the lottery is that you have the contract and monies that run through the Department of State Police, through Danny's shop, and then we have other expenses that are picked up on the lottery side, and I don't know, you know, why some of that happens, but those expenses, and we have quite a bit of out-of-state travel for our vendor team have been paid directly by the lottery from lottery their budget as opposed to the state police's budget.
The other one that showed was $81,000 in expenditures for holiday pay.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hanson, I'd have to defer to Danny on that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hanson would have to look at that number or what you're referring to, if I may. Certainly by contract, they're eligible for holiday pay. But also, if I may, that sometimes can be deceiving because it's an other differential in the payroll system. And so holiday pay is part of that, but we also have education differentials, standby differentials, different types of differentials that are in that category. But we do expend overtime for some of these investigations, and certainly at times they do have to work holiday, but I don't think it's on an ongoing basis. It certainly be some sort of an emergency, but we can follow up on that.
Yeah, one of I can certainly understand having it as a budgeted item. It hadn't been budgeted, though, and I'm wondering, and then. So there was no money budgeted for that classification pay, and then there was $81,000 of costs incurred for it. I'm wondering why that would, for an item that big, why it hadn't been anticipated and listed in the budget. The other question, I think I asked this 2 years ago, was the cost per investigation, per vendor investigation. And the other one I would like to see would be a breakdown in the length of time for your vendor investigations. How many are done in 30 days? How many are done in 60 days? How many are done in excess of that?
So you'll provide that breakout at a later time.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, we will do that. And if I may, Representative Hansen, we could follow up. If we have that document to look at, that $81,000. I apologize for that. We can certainly tell you exactly where those dollars are going this biennium, depending upon how far back you went or what document you're referring to, so we refresh our mind on that as well.
Before we do Bill's walkthrough, I do want to raise an issue that's been raised to me recently, and that was part of my comments in regard to the lottery. In regard to housing the people, OSP officers at the lottery, there is some perception that I believe that OSP is taking its direction from the lottery, which is a monopoly in Oregon, as opposed to taking its direction and objectivity through the state police. And so, consequently, I would be interested to know if there's space available at our central building or other buildings that state police are really housed at, as opposed to being directly housed right there at the lottery. I know that, obviously, if they have an administrative role, that an OSP officer has to be present to review the mail as it is opened. That's an issue, but for those people who don't need to be necessarily on site as a result of either statutory or administrative law, I would like to know if there's space available in other locations that are more appropriate for a policing organization as opposed to being directly housed within the lottery, so that there is some perception and degree of separation that in regards to what goes on. Okay. Do you have anything else to close? You don't have to speak if you don't want to.
Well, Mr. Chair, if it's appropriate, the only thing that I was going to close with was I wanted to bring the committee up to date on where we are legislation-wise. We have one bill out of my division, and it has to do with boxing and wrestling. Big surprise. And what happened this last year is that the Oregon legislature, I think back in 1993, prohibited extreme fighting in the state. And last year, through a circuit court ruling here in Marion County, a no-holds-barred loophole was created. And what that ruling said was that if the promoter of an event prohibited at least one move or eye gouging or whatever, as extreme as it might be, then by definition that would no longer be extreme fighting. And so what the legislature attempted to prohibit was now allowable. And so we've had some problems with tough men competitions. And so this legislation, Senate Bill 178, as proposed, would reinstitute the legislature's policy position on extreme fighting and close that loophole.
Great.
Just for the record, Mr. Chairman, that's okay.
Absolutely.
It actually was then Representative Deckard's bill in 1997, because he took a lot of grief over that bill, I remember.
Bill, you want to take us through the walk?
Sure. Bill McGee, the budget for this division is about $195,000 general fund, that's the salary for the Stocks and Investment Commission, and about $8.3 million in other funds for the moderate. So you've
the budget for this division is about 98% other funds and only 2% general fund. The development of the budget, there were no actions in the special sessions that affected this division. The primary issue in the governor's budget was the shift of the Boxing and Wrestling Commission from other funds to general funds, as approved at the emergency board rebalance in October of 2002. In terms of categories and total fund budget, this is primarily a personal services budget. 83% of the expenditures go for people. Services and supplies, 15%. Capital outlay, 2%. Taking it through the development of the budget, we started to close a session with about $7.7 million in tally other funds. No emergency board actions through April. No special session 2 actions. The base budget adjustments are, again, the position and compensation changes, rolling 2001-03 forward, and then the merit increases again. Essential packages, vacancy savings, non-picks, about 81,000 other funds. Phase in, phase out, the phase out of the incentive pay adjustment that's no longer being used with the officers. And inflation, about $45,000 other funds. State government service charges, about $62,000 other funds. Package 70 reduced the budget by $272,000 other funds in the position. This essentially was a result of the elimination of other funds revenues when the Oregon Tax Court determined that the pay-per-view tax on closed circuit events was not constitutional. The October 2002 rebalance shifted the funds to continue the Boxing and Wrestling Commission with general fund. Package 81, again, the elimination cost of living increase for salary range 38 and above. Package 83 is the action to shift the Boxing and Wrestling Commission to general fund that occurred at the October reboard. And the unique package for this division, package 109, it's an $82,000 other funds issue with a quarter of an FTE. That eliminates one sworn position and establishes an auditor in the tribal gaming section. The department believes that's a better way of dealing with their responsibilities for enforcement in the tribal gaming area. It restores a quarter of a time of a captain's position that had been funded with other funds from the pay-per-view tax and boxing and wrestling events. The position is now being funded through Rider Security and Tribal Gaming instead, so that quarter time is restored. And we've also restored about $20,000 in other funds expenditure limitation for the Boxing Wrestling Commission, just in anticipation of licensing fee revenue that will continue to come in. No major fee or revenue changes here. The general fund is reduced by about $54,000 in technical adjustments, again, just to deal with personal service estimates. We're a little off when we actually loaded the position in the system. And then we need to shift a small amount of service and supplies to state government service charges, as we had a negative ending balance in one unit for state government service charges we needed to fix. And
Bill?
That's all I have.
Questions for Bill?
Welcome, Captain Maurer. Would you like to start off your overview, and we'll get through that, and then we'll probably adjourn before you get into too much detail.
Sure, Patrick, members of the subcommittee, good afternoon. For the record, I'm Captain Maurer, the Director of the Criminal Investigation Division. The Criminal Investigation Division is one of four divisions within the Bureau of Investigation. And in my division, I've got three main investigative sections and one support section. Investigative branches are the Major Crime Section, Drug Enforcement Section, and the Arson Explosive Section. The Investigative Report Section maintains oversight of the criminal police reports in the agency. Our programs and specialized services augment and support local and federal law enforcement agencies statewide. The Major Crime Section is the main investigative branch of our investigators. These are the guys that participate in the multidisciplinary child abuse sex teams, major crime team investigations, perform multitude of investigations. They do everything from homicide, death investigation, all the crimes involving violence, state institution crimes, major fraud and theft crimes, internal criminal investigations of other law enforcement or government agencies upon request, threat assessments, elder abuse, and we also assist in homeland security investigations. Additional specialized investigative services, we also have our polygraph and the forensics computer crimes analytical unit. In the investigative support unit, we have support for the Criminal Investigation Division and other law enforcement agencies as well. We have the Homicide Investigative Tracking System, unidentified deceased records, We have crime analysts who support the major crime teams around the state and the district attorney offices by providing analytical support and investigative support. We also have a 3D recreation still image and animated videos person to do court presentations. We also have an information resource specialist. This is a person that has access to a multitude of databases to assist in locating suspects. We also do threat assessments on personnel and other safety officer safety bulletins. And we are also the statewide contact for Interpol and FINCE in the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network. We also have the Missing Children's Clearinghouse that coordinates the recovery of abducted children. And we also do, these people also do assist in the Amber Alert Telephone Tip Line Coordination Center, which we support local law enforcement agencies that are unable to do due to manpower resources. Sex Offender Registration Unit we have provides a statewide computerized repository for sex offender records in the state. In the drug enforcement section, I've got detectives assigned to local and federal interagency drug task forces. Sometimes these guys do work in an undercover capacity, depending on the case. The majority of my drug enforcement detectives are also clandestine lab site safety officers who go into meth lab conditions, dismantle, seize evidence, and also assist in removing the chemicals. We also have the high-intensity drug trafficking area program, which Oregon has seven counties designated as HIDAs, and the department is a pass-through agency for all HIDA funds. Arson explosive section, detectives are responding to a determined fire cause. There are many law enforcement agencies statewide that don't have this expertise or experience to conduct arson investigations, so we're widely used around the state. We also have two arson accelerant canine dogs to assist fire services around the state, and we also respond to any national incidents upon the request by the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. Our explosives unit is also available to respond to calls for surrender safe explosive devices, as well as provide a service to the public and disposal of found explosives. And we also conduct post-blast investigations as a result of an explosive device. Purpose of our division is pretty simple: provide specialized investigative services in support of criminal justice agencies statewide through innovative programs and highly trained, dedicated personnel. You have the division statutory authorities listed there. I won't go through those. The org chart, I believe you have, shows 148 positions, which I believe from last biennium will show a slight increase, and this is due to the addition of the Office of Public Safety and Security into my division. How we do our services delivered throughout the state, obviously I mentioned before, it's the multitude of the interagency task forces we're involved in statewide. The child sex MBT teams, major crime teams, drug enforcement task forces, and interagency fire investigation teams. As a statewide law enforcement agency, we have the ability to mobilize resources for any major criminal investigation in the state, as we have done so in the past. One of the unique traits I think our detectives have is, even though they may be assigned to a certain section, we've had a major crime section detective assist out on narcotic cases, and we've used drug enforcement detectives to assist on a homicide investigation, depending on the community manpower resources there. So our detectives are well-rehearsed and cross-trained in that aspect. We also do most of the investigations, all the investigations in all the state institutions across the state. We have one primary performance measurement, and it's the percent of major crime team callouts resolved within 12 months of the data callout. This measurement is linked to Public Safety Benchmark 61, which is the overall reported crime per 1,000 Oregonians. We have several factors that are affecting our service currently. Over the last several years, with the DOC and OIA capacity increases due to construction of new state facilities, the increase in caseloads from the institutions begins to start impacting some of our offices around the state. We also have the problem with the current population of registered sex offenders in Oregon continues to be on the increase, and the current growth rate right now is approximately 165 new sex offenders that are required to register each month. It should also be noted that approximately 30% of the inmates currently incarcerated within the penitentiary system are incarcerated for sex crimes, and when they come out, we'll be registering them as well. Also, Oregon continues to rank the top 10 states in the nation for indoor marijuana grow operations. We're ranked 9th in the nation for meth lab seizures last year. We rank 4th in the nation for super labs, and those are the labs that are capable of producing anywhere up to 20 to 25 pounds of methamphetamine a shot. Recent investigations also indicate large quantity seizures of tar heroin in the 1 to 2 pound range, which is a disturbing trend that we in narcotics see. As far as in the arson explosives section, we responded to 210 fire investigation callouts and 268 bomb squad responses. for the presence of domestic terrorism cases involving the Earth Liberation Front and Animal Liberation Front draws enormous resources depending on the magnitude of the investigation. Serial arsonist fires are also becoming very time-consuming, and demented wildland fires can cover quite a large geographic area. We experienced that up in the Corbett area, I believe, where a serial arsonist set about 25 fires before we finally able to take them into custody. So it is a drain on manpower resources. In the environment of modern technology and accelerated advances in software and the Internet, the rapid growth of computer crimes, I'm sure you're all aware of, with identity theft issues, records, child pornography. We for local law enforcement, we provide forensics analysis of computers used. And, in fact, one investigation required, what we do is we mirror the drives and other, for evidentiary purposes, you have to mirror the drive that you're seizing to work off of. And one large case involved 45 drives that we had to mirror. And then you have to go in and kind of pick out what they tried to delete to restore it for a criminal case prosecution. And that's time-consuming. I have four administrative positions. My position, my office manager, the HIDA director that's with HIDA funds, and his program manager is equivalent to 2.88% of the division budget. Again, as far as we participate in local and federal interagency teams to enhance sharing of information, we believe it reduces the duplication of enforcement effort and maximizes law enforcement in each community. We are involved in one intergovernmental program through a contract with the State Office of Alcohol and Drug Abuse Programs. I think you're all familiar with it, called the SINAR program, and that's doing a juvenile tobacco sting around the state, and we use retired state police officers for that. We've taken some actions to control the costs and implement efficiencies. Overtime has to be approved by a supervisor. It's mostly restricted to major crime cases or cases needing immediate attention and follow-up, particularly child sex abuse cases. We continue to drive our program vehicles, or our actual criminal vehicles, to 120,000 miles prior to replacement requests. We monitor all training requests to validate the need of any specified training, and those who we send off to specialized training, we ask them to come back and try to encapsulate and do some training to the rest of our officers on any specialty type of training they received out of state. The most recent we did was one called the Trident Interview and Cognitive Interview Techniques, which we held for all detectives statewide, and we also invited local law enforcement. If they wanted to attend that, they were welcome to. Other than that, I guess I'll turn it over to Mr. McGee.
Real quick question.
Yeah. You're the chair.
Okay. on the forensics, the analyzation of the 45 drives. Criminal investigation does that, or
yes.
Do you do that in the forensics lab?
No, okay. We don't have people. It takes an enormous amount of training. In fact, these guys have to get certified once a year and spend 2 weeks to get certified to be accredited to be in a court of law. They get the latest new software every year because as the computer technology grows, you need new software to be able to do this. So, yeah, we do it. The forensic labs do not. And because the other parts of it, our guys may have to prepare a search warrant affidavit to actually get a computer, so it's an investigative process and a forensics process.
Actually, I may be able to help you out. I'm getting a man in Nigeria wants to give me $160 million. I'm just sending my
Representative Hampson, I've already beat you to it. I already got the $100
million. Not that I didn't care.
We turned it over to him. He was over here.
Good. Absolutely.
All right. Boy, this sounds strange coming from a very, very conservative Republican. But I would tell you, I look at your responsibilities, and I'm thinking, that's not enough people. Now, my question for you, when I look at, you know, the sex offender population, I look at the drug issues here, I need to be number one or number 10 or number 8 or 4 on any of these things. Do we have, and with tar heroin coming in here, do we have enough people to handle what I think is in the...
We're the lowest number of law enforcement officers per capita
in
the country.
Yeah, you wrote down 100 for me, sir. Well, Senator George...
I'm going home with a headache again today. You know that, don't you?
Sure, Patrick, Senator George. Sex offender, it is because it's a continued case increase of what you see. The people that I've got working are very dedicated, and to tell you the truth, at times I feel they're drinking out of a fire hose. But we maintain and do the best we can. in criminal investigations, I think, not just us but all the other law enforcement agencies, it's you start prioritizing cases, what you can get to, the ones who, the people who are, you know, the child sex abuse cases where the child's in immediate danger, you work on now, and these other ones that came up through the channel, you just end up triaging if you can. But it is enormous with the problems that we're going through, seeing what other law enforcement agencies are cutting back as well.
Follow-up real quick?
Yes.
One issue, a few years ago, I made a pass around this hill and had somebody come out and point a gun at me, and so we notified authorities. We have our aircraft in here relative to fish and wildlife issues. I'm sure those guys are trained to look for things along the way. Do we have anything that encourages the average pilot that's out doing recreational flying, if they see somebody suspicious, to report it, or you just depend upon someone to make the decision we did? Point a gun at me, I call them.
Chair Patrick, Senator Dewar Douglas, that would probably have to depend on how high they're flying.
Yeah,
first of all, you know, we haven't. I know we've, the Civil Air Patrol, a lot of it gets down to search and rescue, and I think a lot of the other parts, I'm not sure that pilots, unless they're really geared to look for something specific, like in a search and rescue mission or a marijuana eradication flight, that they really look, that they're mostly maintaining and wanting to get from point A to point B safely. It'd be tough to start training civilians to spot marijuana first. So.
Senator Devil.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm looking at the organizational chart, and it has a provision for seasonals.
Yes.
And what is the kind of work that they do?
Okay, Chair Patrick, Senator Devil, I think the seasonals, what we have, I believe the three high to limited duration positions are in that, and the other that are left over is the SINAR Juvenile Tobacco Task Force, the retired detectives that use juveniles to go out and do tobacco stings around the state, because I'm not sure the proper name of the used to be the Office of Alcohol and Drug Abuse gets federal grant money for treatment programs, and they are mandated to conduct X amount of inspection in the state or take a loss on their federal grant monies. So it's just retired state police detectives and tobacco stings.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Sorry,
this is a different question, actually. In terms of the background, the extensive background of some of your officers, I know that there are few law enforcement agencies that can spare, somebody going off for a month or two for training or something like that. But has there ever been any kind of program where you might take in a law enforcement officer from a jurisdiction that would not have the as much capability just for training purposes? I'm not saying thinking of the city of Portland, but I'm thinking, you know, sometimes we get this remark about that, you know, departments are so small that sometimes law enforcement officers don't get exposure to some of the things that they might get exposure to in their careers, where a month or two in a division like yours might give them some exposure to something.
Chair Patrick, Senator Devlin, I don't think we've researched that. A lot of times, particularly in a task force situation or a multidisciplinary team type of deal, where you have a pool of experienced investigators, you bring a new investigator into, that's a real good learning environment in a task force environment. When you get into search and seizure issues and stuff like that, I think DOJ, DPSST does a good job. Our training division, I believe, has held some training for other patrol officers on issues as well. We as a division, when I do regional training around the state, and for instance on this Trident interview techniques, we invited other law enforcement. We did it statewide around the region so our detectives didn't have to travel. We only had to pay per diem and lodging for two detectives to go around the state. And we invited local law enforcement and says, hey, it's an quick eight-hour down and dirty course, but you're more than welcome to come and do that. So we try to do that as much as we can.
Thank you very much.
Yes.
Captain, I'm looking at page 9, specifically bottom page 8, top page 9. In regards to the decisions that you've made in regards to the governor's balanced budget, I'm looking at the item that specifically affects the chair's patrol office out in Southern Oregon and Detective Beck specifically and his drug dog. Why would you choose to make that decision when you've got a substantial investment in the dog? Is it, I haven't talked to Dave lately,
right.
So I don't know.
Well, currently right now, I think, Chair Patrick, Detective Beck is actually helping out on the MCS side and being a drug dog secondarily. What we get down to is the dog is of a valuable deal. It's one drug dog.
it comes down to, in talking with my region lieutenant, he wants that major crime team investigator available, because down in the southern Oregon we are hurting. The last Curry County homicide we responded to, he sent four detectives over to help them out because they were short-strapped. So I think in the essence of it, you know, trying to prioritize drugs are important, but homicides are important. Where does he fit into that picture? Obviously, the ideal situation is if he can do both, but it kind of puts a cramp on the drug task force.
So you talk to Lieutenant Rommel, then.
Yes, sir.
All right,
yes,
I'd be happy to do that. Thank you.
You bet.
Any other questions?
Mr. Chair, one thing, since you were on the org chart, the one thing that's missing on the org chart is, and I remind the committee of this again, is the tobacco compliance task force staff that is not funded in the governor's budget.
Okay. I have a meeting to go to. If you want to do the walk with Bill, what's the... Do you guys want to go ahead and do that? Finish that out? I'll be here tomorrow, though, too. I don't know what other people's schedules are.
There's no meeting tomorrow.
Or, I mean, Monday. Monday.
Actually, I can get ready for another committee meeting.
Because I'm supposed to go to the governor's office, but I stayed, so... And Doug's supposed to be there, too. Right?
3:30.
Yeah. Or 2:30. Say 2. It's 2:30. Oh, we got time. Jeez Louise. We're moving. Sorry. I looked up and thought it was 3:30. Time flies when you're having fun. Bill.
Okay,
sorry.
Thank you. Bill McGee, budget
management.
The numbers for this division are 23.46 million dollars general fund, $4.5 million other funds, and $4.8 million federal funds. Other funds increase largely due to reorganization with the department. The federal funds increase is due to a very large increase in federal support for the high-intensity drug trafficking area, or HIDTA program. About 71% of this division is general fund. Other funds and federal funds are about equal, about 14 to 15% each. A portion of that other funds is the fire insurance premium tax issue we talked about yesterday, so it requires a legislative fix for those revenues, in fact, to be there. So I'm sure we'll be talking about some more. The stepping through the major changes during the special sessions were the elimination of 25 detectives in House Bill 5100 and the compensation funding at 75%. The major issues in the governor's budget are the arson detectives. They're funded with revenues anticipated from the legislative fix on the fire insurance premium tax, and the transfer of the Capitol Mall Legislative Security and Dignitary Protection Unit from Patrol Division into the Office of Public Safety and Security in this division. So as Doug indicated, since
Doug, can you hold on a second, Bill?
Quick question, so I can get all this in balance. On that shift for the dignitary protection and stuff into approximately how much money was involved in that?
Let's see. We actually have that. Is it a package? That's in package 106 on page 11. Actually, there's more than just that unit, but it's primarily that. There's also a major going from human resources and a captain from the training division, a couple of cadets. The net of that is about $2 million general fund, about 3.7 total funds. If you want just those units, we can get you that specific.
Well, that's all I need to know in terms of just kind of understanding the flow of the whole thing. Yeah.
Okay. Finally, as Doug indicated, Senate Bill 5548 has restored five detectives for the tobacco enforcement unit to $87,000-ish other funds. That is not included in the governor's budget, and there would be a roll-off of $787,000 if you would continue that in the 0305 budget. And the budget for this unit is primarily personal services, again, 73%, 14% services supplies, the capital outlays 3%, and a small amount for special payments. That's the total fund budget. The general fund budget is even more heavily personal services at about 85%, and again, a very small amount for capital outlay for equipment and vehicles. Walking you through the budget, we started to close the session at about $21.4 million general fund, about $25 million total fund. Emergency board through April, so a couple of actions there. General fund, $685,000 for the Tobacco Enforcement Task Force, and about $3.3 million total funds. And most of the rest of that was for the federal high-intensity drug trafficking area grant, a HIDA grant. The second special session just made a small reduction in services supplies of about $18,000. Base budget adjustments are just the general compensation issues for about 2.6 general fund, 2.7 total funds, and the estimated cost of the step increases about $220,000 general fund, $232,000 other funds. Essential packages, 010s, vacancy savings, non-picks for about $276,000 general fund, $440,000 total. The phase-in, phase-outs reduced general fund by about $52,000. That was primarily the restoration of other funds reductions and phase-out from the second special session that were designated as one-timers, and the phase-out of the Social Security Fraud Unit that had been funded by the Department of Human Services that won't continue. Package 30, inflation adjustment of about $113,000 general fund, $233,000 total funds, and state government service charges about $349,000 general, $366,000 total. Package 70, here's the fire insurance premium tax reduction. That would eliminate two arson detectives, reducing other funds by $1.3 million. Those positions are restored, again, assuming a legislative fix. Third special session made a small reduction in general fund and total funds as a result of the elimination of cost of living increase for salary range 38 and above. Package 83, the October Emergency Board, reduced general fund by $316,000. This was a reduction of overtime, salary differentials, capital outlays, and an increase in services supplies in this division as part of that rebalance. Special session 5, package 91, that eliminated 25 detectives, reducing general fund next by annum by $3.6 million. Package 105 for this division increased other funds and federal funds by $467,000, 9 positions, 7.61 FTE. A couple of different things going on. There's a shift from service and supplies to personal service to establish two positions for double fills that were hired in 2001-2002. No increase in funding for that. It reestablishes three limited duration positions, reclassifies one permanent position as part of the support for the HIDA program. Those are federally funded actions. And finally, it shifts funding from temporaries to salaries and benefits to establish four part-time limited duration positions for temporaries, again, to appropriately fund how those activities are going on.
Thanks, Bill. Captain Maron, can you tell me how you... We're obviously in a very tight budget situation. The chart has your offices around the state. I'm wondering how you, in administering your particular division, make the choices about which types of resources are provisioned where in the state, and if there's duplicative local resources that are available.
Chair Patridge, I have the three region lieutenants who oversee all the criminal investigations in each of the three regions you see up there on the board. I interact with them quite a bit to see where we've got people based, what their job duties are. In this last go-around, we've had to swap, and where I may have maintained a drug enforcement detective, we might have swapped them over to work major crimes priority, and maybe try to help out with drug enforcement on a case-by-case basis. We know the rural areas are the hardest hit. They rely on us quite a bit. So what we try to do is look at the bigger offices and see what core things we want to maintain. Obviously looking at with the impacts with, do I have less polygraphers? Is there a need? We generate, look at statistics by numbers. Where's our biggest areas that outside law enforcement comes to us versus an internal OSP type of a deal? We look at the number of child abuse cases, who does most of the work in what areas, and what other agencies have available to do what types of cases.
Okay. And I guess an additional question to that is, do you have issues placing highly trained detectives and major homicide, people who have been trained with major homicide places in places like Burns and Ontario, who may not have those duplicative resources? How do you deal with that in your division?
Chair Patrick, if I understand your question,
What's funny is this, there for about a six-month period of time, I could have sworn that the moon was full on Eastern Oregon because we were running our guys rampant all over that east side. You know, when something comes up in those rural areas such as Burns, I've got a major crime detective, I think, in John Day right now. Detective Mike Dewar was the one that was shot on that last incident. He helps out the DA's office quite a bit over there on some substantial homicide investigations, does a lot of follow-up. Travel time is an issue, too, in that eastern region. If I, you know, base people in one area and they spend 4 hours in a car trying to go somewhere to do an investigation, really cuts down time. So we try to put them out in these core areas to minimize the travel time. We have them in these pocket areas, but, of course, if Detective Dewar goes on vacation, I'm shipping people from Baker and wherever else if they ask.
I'd be interested just a little bit more in the distribution, more specifically as to the specialized services, like the arson services. Somebody typically is probably not going to have anyone trained locally as well as OSP is. Those types of things. The drug enforcement thing, there's a lot more. Drug-trained officers around the state than there would be major homicide investigation or arson types of.
Sure, Patrick, right now I think we're looking at the major crime section is heavier than the drug enforcement. I think I'd have, like I said, 8 arson investigators.
No, I can see that by your chart. What I'm interested in is how you've distributed your resources statewide so that we can see how your specialized resources are distributed when we make some, when we make some budgetary decisions. I mean, I ask about Detective Beck, but I know that there are several drug dogs in Southern Oregon that pull up and work with the local drug teams there. Well, I love Dave and his dog and everything else.
It's a good dog. I can do that.
All right. Further questions, Doug? Anything?
Did you finish, Bill? Or
I just got a couple of.
Oh, I'm sorry, Bill. I'm having a rough afternoon. Can you tell?
Not a problem.
All right.
Okay. I'm almost done. Page 11, just the last two packages. The package 106, again, is the reorganization issue that we talked about with the transfer of the different units into this division. About $2 million general fund, about $3.7 million total funds, 20 positions, party transfer. Package 161 deals with the fire insurance premium tax and restores two positions, $1.3 million other funds. The assumption there is some sort of a legislative remedy of the choices that are being considered. That's the only fee and revenue change, and we've just got a couple of technical adjustments that would increase the budget for the division by $229,000 general fund and three positions. We eliminated three positions in error in preparing the governor's budget. We'd like to restore those. They should have been part of a transfer rather than be eliminated. And again, we need to adjust the personal services amounts that we estimated based on what the real final amounts were. And that does conclude my presentation.
Thanks, for the record.
Chair Patridge, I'll finish out due to the time. The only thing I'll mention is the department is a sponsor of Senate Bill 176, which would bring Oregon into compliance with the Federal Campus Sex Crimes Prevention Act. We've been working with Senator Vinicius Committee on that. And other than that, sir, and committee members, I've concluded with my testimony.
Great. Anything further? Anything for the good of the order?
All right.
They outlasted us.